Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, the most hated tax in Britain. As the amount raised by inheritance tax is set to more than double over the decade, is it about to be axed? If it is, where will the government find the billions to replace it? Meanwhile, the ISA allowance may be hiked above 20 grand. That's if you invest in UK company shares. Also today, a year on from the Bank of England's intervention after the mini budget, where were we at this time last year? Mortgage rates are continuing to be cut and energy bills are going to fall this week. But will you see any difference? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, the amount raised by inheritance tax is set to rise from $7 billion a year to $15 billion over the next decade. That's according to a new report from the IFS, and you can bet your bottom pound that it won't be coming from the super rich. Well, Rishi Sunak is reportedly considering cutting and ultimately scrapping inheritance tax altogether. But will it happen? Well, our most hated tax, apparently, Simon, but only around 4% of estates pay it. What's wrong with inheritance tax?
It is Britain's most hated tax, inheritance tax. That's what it's always dubbed as. Rightly so, I think, because whenever you write anything about it, you get a major backlash from readers. They really don't like it. You get it in the comments, we get it in our emails, we get it in the polls that we run. And actually, many of those people, statistically speaking, are probably unlikely to be affected by it. Now, of course, This Is Money's readers are going to skew towards people more likely to be affected by inheritance tax. But there is a real groundswell of opinion that is anti-inheritance tax. And the most hated tax thing goes back to a poll that was done some time ago. I can't remember the exact details of it, but inheritance tax came out top, even though not that many people pay it. But there are some caveats to that. Firstly, more people are now paying it, so the number of people affected by the tax will also grow. The IFS had some figures out this week that said in a decade, one in eight people, so 12%, are set to have inheritance tax due when either they or their partner dies. And then you can sort of multiply that out, because actually, in many cases, whilst that person's estate will be affected by the tax, the people who inherit from them are likely to be a larger number. So there's a large number of people who are affected by the tax on estates that they inherit. It's also levied at a very high rate of 40%, which, although there is a fairly generous allowance, so £325,000 per individual, you can pass that on to your spouse or civil partner. You can then have an extra own home allowance that you can pass on to your direct descendants if you pass on your own home, of up to £175,000 per individual. So you can have a total £1 million. So that's £1 million is a lot. But there's some nasty catches in there. You're not married, you get stuffed. You don't have direct descendants, you get stuffed. But then above that, it gets taxed at 40%. And 40% represents a quite sizable percentage of the next pound, and a quite sizable amount of money in many cases. And people don't think of it as, well, my estate's worth £1.5 million, and that means that it'll only be 40% on the 500. And actually, if you work out the 40% on the 500 as an effective rate of tax on the 1.5 million, it's much lower than 40%. They think of it as 40% of 500 grand. That's an awful lot of money. That's £200,000. £200,000 to the government of my hard-earned money that I paid tax on through my lifetime, and I saved and I invested and I was frugal, and all I want to do is pass it on to my descendants, and instead they're going to tax me even when I'm dead. They'll be taxing the air that I breathe next. You can see how the logic goes. And actually, I've got a poll here on the website that indicates quite how unpopular this is. If you were Chancellor, what would you do about inheritance tax? And about 3,500 people have voted in this. The most popular was abolish it altogether at 48%, then raise the threshold was at 28%, cut the 40% rate, was at 12%. The wealthiest should pay most, squeeze them more, did come in at 6%, followed by change the gifting rules. It's fair, keep it the same. A really chunky 2% said keep it the same. And something else just said 1%. So we thought we'd give them to something else. But this gives you an indication of how disliked this is, that it would be highly unlikely that we could run a poll about most taxes. And the number one answer, with nearly 50% of people saying it, would just say abolish it altogether. But we'll get it more into this in a minute. But the problem is we're not really in the kind of economic position where we can be abolishing taxes, even if people really don't like them, without the government or the party that wants to be in government suggesting this, taking an absolute pasting from the other side, who weaponize it politically, even though actually most people probably think it's not a bad idea.
Absolutely right. I mean, most people won't pay this, to be fair. But you mentioned there in your poll that one of the options was that the wealthiest should shoulder the burden. But Helen, one of the arguments, I guess, with, you know, where will they get those missing billions from if they scrap, or not scrap it, but cut it, would be, well, if you cut it, more of the richer people are less likely to pay their money to super duper accountants and more likely to pay it to the government in tax.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really politically tricky one, isn't it? You know, any cut can potentially be taken as, you know, a boon for the wealthiest. I think they'd be really unlikely to kind of abolish it outright. You know, we're in this environment where the government is saying, you know, we need to sort the country's finances, you know, kind of moving back to almost a bit of kind of austerity. So I think abolishing it outright isn't probably going to happen. The other thing to mention, I mean, it's seen as reasonably likely at the minute that the next government is going to be a Labour government. So this, none of this might matter, even if they do scrap it. It is one of those things, isn't it? It's all kind of quite up in the air and we don't know. I think probably if they do go for this, the most likely option is to raise the threshold. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because people who have a, so for a couple, your descendants won't pay it unless you have basically 1 million in assets between a married couple. That seems like quite a lot of money. You'd assume that they might be quite wealthy people, but actually, you know, with the way that, because the thing that most people pass on is their property, right? And if you think about people who maybe live in London, say they bought a property many years ago and that's gone up in value, in theory, I mean, they might quite easily have a property that's gone up to be worth a million. You know, those people aren't necessarily hugely wealthy people.
Also, not everyone's married either.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That's something I was going to mention. So I think, like many sort of financial policies, it's something that hasn't really kept pace with modern life. So it's quite unfair. You know, if you don't have children, you miss out on the extra tax-free allowance. If you're not married, you could find yourself having to pay that tax bill because the exemption is only for married couples. So yeah, I think like a lot of things, it hasn't really kept pace with the way that people live nowadays. And maybe that's something the government could look to address to, you know, make it a bit fairer.
And in fact, actually, it didn't even keep pace with the way that people lived in the past, where there was a very famous case with two sisters where they lost out because they couldn't pass it on to each other and they lived together. And the surviving sister was forced to sell her home. And in fact, actually, my mum's old next door neighbours were a brother and sister that lived together. And the brother died, and I believe he was affected by it as well. So that was a house that they had in later life moved into and they'd lived in together. And there are examples of where this affects people, you know, all through. It doesn't even have to just be partners. I mean, at least partners have the opportunity of going, OK, well, do you know what? We don't really want to get married, but we're just going to do this because it's beneficial for tax, or the civil partnerships is beneficial for tax. But you know, some people don't have that opportunity. Without going into the politics of this, there is some politics going on, obviously, because the reason why we're talking about this is because it's been floated that the Tories might say that they're going to abolish it. I would be very surprised if they said they were going to abolish it. I think they'll do something else instead, because they know how weaponized this will be against them, regardless of how much people dislike it. You know, Keir Starmer's already come out this week, and there's indications that he's going to say the opposite. He's going to crack down on the loopholes that means that inheritance tax doesn't raise as much. Now, a loophole can be something for example, which the IFS has recommended, which is removing the beneficial effect of owning farmland, for example, or owning forestry, which actually these things really skew other markets. They have impacts that go way beyond tax and inheritance and things like that. So if you are a farmer and you want to buy more land, or if you are a small somebody who wants to get into farming and you don't come from a family that has farmland, it is almost impossible across the UK to do that due to the incredibly high price of land. One of the things behind the incredibly high price of land is rich people buying it up, and then they pay someone to farm it for them because they can then pass it on free of inheritance tax. I don't think that's why the inheritance tax system allows for no inheritance on farmland. I think it was designed so that like genuine farmers with family farms didn't end up losing the farm. Pretty sure that was what it was for. And there are examples I know of near where my father-in-law lives in Shropshire, where there is a landowner buying up farmland, and he buys the farmland and the farmland is farmed, but the farmhouses remain empty, which is, you know, that's not really what you want to be happening. So there's some loopholes there that they want, that the IFS says, you know, get rid of. There's some other things that might be classed as a loophole, such as the 7-year rule, passing on assets to people, and after 7 years they're free of inheritance tax. Some of the gifting elements, but the gifting elements are way out of date. And there was a big report done into inheritance tax that was asked for by Philip Hammond when he was Chancellor. Remember him? And he asked the Office of Tax Simplification to come up with a plan to overhaul inheritance tax. And they did a deep dive into it, and it laid bare quite what a completely nuts tax it has become. The fact that it was a mess of loopholes, overly complex rules, unfair elements, outdated allowances. You can give away £3,000 a year in total, and anything above that is liable for inheritance tax. So if you buy your child a car, their first car, which lots of parents are probably going to want to go above the £3,000 mark because they want something that's going to be reliable and safe and all these other things. I would argue you could probably go below the £3,000 mark, get a perfectly decent car, but that's not what lots of people are going to do. Somebody goes out, buys their 18-year-old a £5,000 car, and then has the misfortune to die in the next 7 years. That now falls into their estate. £2,000 of that car does. But only if they haven't given away any other money the rest of that year. Then there's this thing where you can give away money from excess income that most people don't realise about and probably could actually do more of. There's the bit where you can give some money for a wedding, hasn't kept pace with the cost of the wedding. There's the limit itself. I mean, as Helen pointed out, a lot of what people leave is their property. The own home allowance that pushed it up to 1 million came in 2017. House prices have risen 44% since then. I mean, arguably, maybe the inheritance tax threshold should be 1.45 million, or maybe it should be indexed to inflation. It probably shouldn't just be sitting at exactly the same level. Mm. I mean, the triple lock goes up by either 2.5% wages or inflation.
Mm.
Why doesn't the inheritance tax threshold go up by a combination of either property prices, asset prices, or inflation, or something like that? So there's all these problems with it. And then also the OTS report highlighted that the richer you are, the less you pay proportionately, that there comes a point where as people get wealthier, they go over that £1 million and they go over the £2 million, where you start to get the own home allowance taken back off you again, another slightly crazy bit of the rules. And then, you know, so the relative level of tax people pay goes up until they hit a certain point where they're really quite rich, you know, the kind of 5 million kind of level, and then it starts to go down again, so that you get people paying a much lower effective rate of tax. So they said, basically, this is a complete mess and we need to overhaul it, and it hasn't been overhauled. Why hasn't it been overhauled? Because it is a political football.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would argue, if you just bear with me for another couple of minutes, that the problem is you don't want to be in the position of being a skint country with bad taxes. And that is unfortunately where we are. When I say skint, I don't mean we're going to go bust. We're not going to go bust. I mean skint as in the way you would personally describe yourself when someone says, you know, do you want to go out for dinner? You go, no, I can't. I'm a bit skint, I'm afraid. you don't have the money. You have the money to get by, to pay for the stuff you need to do, to pay your rent, to pay your mortgage, to get to work, to all that kind of stuff, but you're skint. Now, that's us at the moment. We don't really have enough money to pay for all the stuff that we need to do. Have a look at the state of the roads. You know, that tells you a lot about our country. But we also have a number of bad taxes that have got worse over the years. So inheritance tax has become a bit of a cash cow, but it's a really bad tax. Capital gains tax, bravo to the government, managed to turn that one into a bad tax as well. Income tax, in theory, quite a good tax, progressive, etc. But it's full of mess. It's full of messes. It's got the freezing of the thresholds that's dragged more people into it. It's got the crazy child benefit thing that creates that wild effective tax rate. It's got the removal of the personal allowance and so on and so on. So even income tax has become a bad tax. National insurance is quite a bad tax because effectively it's an income tax that's pretending not to be an income tax. And also there's this thing where people, once you reach state pension age, even if you're still working, you don't pay NI. Now, ideally, what you would do is you would take the axe to all of those taxes, not abolish all of them. I'm not that crazy, but you would try to sort them out. The problem is the government can't try to sort them out, because if they try to sort them out, a lot of the bad bits of them are effectively hitting the wealthy hardest. So they get attacked for helping the wealthy. But they're attacked for helping the wealthy, to be honest, by an opposition that also won't do it because they don't want to be attacked for helping the wealthy, but know full well that these taxes are quite bad. Now, maybe what we should have done when the economy was in real trouble, you know, COVID era or something like that, when you really got hardly any money coming in, you're just having to chuck money at everything. That's the time to do what companies do, and you kitchen sink it. You get all the bad news out in one. That would have been the time for Rishi Sunak to just go, right, you know what, I'm gonna sort this out right now. But obviously we didn't do that. And we haven't done it yet. And I'm not holding my breath, to be honest, for us to do it. But I actually genuinely think that most people in the country, the kind of centre element, right? So, you know, it's all very nice to have the idealistic element, but I think it's probably more important at the moment to have the realistic element in charge of policy. I think most people in the kind of centre ground of this country, which, like, let's face it, is the vast majority of the population, would probably be quite pleased if somebody actually did take the bull by the horns and sort some of this stuff out.
Yeah, it would be lovely. And this is the issue, right? I think most people would be happy paying tax if you think that, one, it's fair, and two, it goes in the right places. And I don't think that people believe that either of those two things are happening at the moment. And inheritance tax was supposed to be something that focused on the supremely wealthy. And if, as Simon says there, the latest research talking about how, what is it, one in 12 people are going to end up paying it, that doesn't seem the supremely wealthy. We've also got reports today, the IFS saying that this government on course to oversee the biggest tax raising parliament since records began. That's not low tax Rishi that he was promising when he was chancellor. By the way, I had to check Philip Hammond. Goodness me, six chancellors ago. It was only 2019. He stopped. Grough. That is some turnover in jobs there. Helen, we're so heavily taxed.
Yeah, we are. And I think with this inheritance tax stuff, it's just going to affect more and more people, especially if you think about, like Simon was saying, parents helping out their kids buying a car. I mean, more and more young people are having to rely on their parents for things like a house deposit. You know, we're hearing more and more that parents are having to give their kids money just to help with their day-to-day expenses. And if it gets to the point where those kind of gifts are being pulled into inheritance tax, I mean, this is helping. This is affecting what you would call normal people, the middle ground of people. And it's just going to keep going in a circle, isn't it? You know, young people are getting poorer, old people are being taxed more on the money they give to them. Like, where does it end? And I think as well, it's this policy, if the government do decide to cut down on, you know, on inheritance tax, it kind of seems like this is a policy for people who predominantly would probably already vote Tory. I kind of think, you know, if they want to pull in new voters, you know, maybe do something to help younger people who are trying to, as they say, sort of work hard and get ahead, you know, do bring back something like Help to Buy. In my mind, that would be a better vote winner for people who aren't already necessarily for them.
The young people vote as much.
So I genuinely think if you were Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt and you laid out why the tax system is in a mess, and why it's in much more of a mess than it was, and how changing those things will actually benefit younger workers, people in their 30s, 40s, and so on, and improve things for them, then that would potentially be a vote winner. I think people would actually potentially listen to that. You need to just explain it properly and get the messaging right. Because if you explain it like that and say, well, do you know what? Actually, don't be fooled by this whole, it's older, richer people benefiting from this. It's not. It's you lot who are going to benefit from this, because you're going to end up with more money in your pocket and a better ability to save and invest. And you might just, if you're really lucky, end up being as rich as your parents, because that is a genuine problem for people in their 30s and 40s. I don't think they're going to be anywhere near able to build up the same kind of level of lifetime wealth as the people in their kind of late 50s, 60s, 70s have done. And if that was laid out that way, then I think that would be quite a difficult thing for the opposition to attack. And likewise, if you were Keir Starmer or Rachel Reeves, if you're listening, why don't you lay that out and do it? Why don't you say, do you know what? This isn't about cutting taxes for the wealthy. This is about giving today's workers a better deal than they're getting and trying to get them back on track to aspire to the same things and achieve the same things that their parents' generation achieved. Because I think the Tories would find that very difficult to attack. It'd be a lot better than the thing where they've basically just like set the tables up at either end of the room and they're like throwing shoes at each other about stuff.
Indeed. Meanwhile, the ISA limit could be made, let's go there, more generous to encourage us to invest in British companies. Under current rules, adults can save 20 grand a year into individual savings accounts without being taxed. But Jeremy Hunt is reportedly considering offering an additional allowance strictly for money invested into companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. It's for ordinary folks to get involved. I don't know how many ordinary folks can save more than £20,000 a year, but there you go. Helen, ISAs. I mean, they started off fairly simple, and then it just got, like so many things, a little bit messy.
Yeah, I do think people find the ISA rules a bit confusing. So, under the current rules, adults can save £20,000 a year into ISAs without being taxed, which sounds simple enough, as you say. But the complications come because there's several different types of accounts. So you've got cash ISAs, stocks and shares ISAs, and a few other kind of less popular types, innovative finance ISAs and things like that. So this is where it gets confusing. So you can save £20,000 a year into ISAs, but that would have to be split across the different types of accounts. And you can only open one of each type of ISA in each year. So already this is something which I think most people looking at it might think, oh, this is a bit confusing. I'll probably either just stick to a cash ISA and, you know, put the rest of my money somewhere else, or, you know, just kind of not bother at all. I mean, the thing you have to point out as well is, you know, not a lot of people don't actually need an ISA. If you're saving less than £20,000 a year, you can get a better rate on an easy access current account at the minute, I think. But for people who do need them, yeah, it's confusing. I've looked into this before when I've considered opening a new ISA, and it's just a bit like, this don't really understand. And I probably actually might just not bother having two ISAs because I don't know if I'm going to end up being taxed or not. And it is confusing. I think the rules are confusing anyway.
Is this a good thing? Is this a good idea? This kind of like tinkering around, trying to encourage people to invest in British? I mean,
hot on the heels of convincing pension funds to stick 5% of their money into unlisted UK companies because it was going to give people's pensions a big boost, which are quite risky. Unlisted UK companies, but you know, I mean, it should help the kind of startup scene. Money going into the UK stock market, though, I mean, in an ISA you have to hold something that is stock market listed. Is that going to help UK PLC? I mean, it depends. If it goes into smaller companies, then potentially yes, that capital would be beneficial. If it goes into mid-sized companies, maybe too. But if it starts going into the big FTSE 100 giants, I mean, is it really going to help BP or Vodafone or BT or Tesco? I mean, probably not. But also, there is an element whereby you're then starting to slightly skew people's investment decisions. Say, for example, in order to make this work, you need to give people a meaningful amount more money in their allowance. So, for example, you said you can have £5,000 extra. Now, if somebody filled their whole £20,000 ISA allowance and they invested all of it, and then they had another £5,000 they put into UK companies, that would mean that they had a 20% allocation of their entire portfolio of that money going into UK companies, which is way more than the UK stock market's representation in the global index. So they're taking a bet on the UK outperforming, because if it doesn't outperform, they're going to fall behind the market, because the market, the global market, doesn't include 20% of the UK. So you are creating a risk there, and then you're creating a risk that if the UK does badly, they're going to lose more money. And also, you are probably doing that to investors who already have a degree of home bias within their investments. People are more likely to pick investments from their own country. The easiest thing you can do as an investor is just take a global stock market tracker fund. But people quite often don't do that, and they'll pick, you know, a selection of actively managed funds or actively managed investment trusts and so on, that will often quite often tend to focus more on the UK. Now, if you're going for the big companies in the UK, that's less of an issue, because those FTSE 100 giants aren't really that exposed to the UK. They're more exposed to the global economy. But the further down scale, the more of an issue that you have.
You mentioned they're the pensions. You mentioned they're the ISAs. What other ideas are on the table here?
Well, I mean, as I just said, that does create that degree of home bias, and you're creating extra risk in people's portfolios. I can see what Jeremy Hunt wants to do here. Whether it would be effective, I don't know. I think more importantly, to go back to what we were talking about with inheritance tax, is that the ISA system needs an overhaul. And again, this is something that's been floated numerous times before. It's got increasingly complex, as Helen talked about, and it's to the detriment of consumers and to the detriment of businesses trying to enter into this kind of stocks and shares ISA space, I would argue. So, for example, you've got your £20,000 allowance. Most people can't use all of that, but you know, they might, maybe they get £10,000. Even most people can't do £10,000. But say you only wanted to go for cash, you can only pay cash into one type of cash ISA each year. You can only pay new money into one cash ISA each year. So you can't say, right, I'm going to put half of my 10 into a fixed rate, because I think that 6% I can get off a fixed rate is great, and I'm going to put the other half into an easy access account. So you have to either go all fixed or all easy access. So it's to the detriment of the saver, because they're not able to apportion their money. There are a few banks and building societies that let people do this, but it's a bit fiddly, and it'd be much better if, as long as you stayed below the £20,000 allowance, you could put money into as many different cash ISAs as you want in each year. And then with the stocks and shares scenario, there's real inertia in people moving investment accounts. They often have a reasonable amount of money in them. They've got lots of different holdings. They worry about what will happen when they try to transfer it. Will they end up out of the market? Is it really worth them doing it? And actually, in many cases, it is. And if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/platforms, you'll find our roundup of all of the top DIY investing platforms, which will help you understand whether you could potentially save hundreds of pounds a year by moving to a different one. But lots of people won't do that. But what they also won't do is they won't just try out a new one, because they'll already have money in an existing one. And they might go, right, well, I want to pay some new money into my existing one, because I want to top up those holdings. But I'd also like to try out this new service here. And some of them are better for other things than others. So some of them are better for funds, but others are better for shares and investment trusts. Or it might be that they do different services. So you might want to have some in your Hargreaves Lansdown Interactive Investor AJ Bell account, where you pick your own investments yourself. You might want to have some in something like Free Trade, where you can buy and sell shares for free because you want to have a shares portfolio. You might want to have something in something like Nutmeg or Money Farm or Wealthify, a digital wealth manager, where they do some of it for you. And actually, it might be a good idea for you to go, right, I've got my £10,000, just like I have in my savings account, and I'm going to put £5,000 into it in something that I pick myself. I'm going to put £5,000 into something that I get the experts to do it for me. But you can't do that. So it's to the detriment of the consumer, and it's to the detriment of companies coming in and trying to cut prices and compete with the established rivals, because the established rivals have a massive advantage, because their customers are like, oh, well, I would try out this new service, but I can't because I've got my money in here. So they don't do it. So I think an overhaul would be better. And I think as long as you stick below the £20,000, you should be able to open as many accounts as you want to. And that's the easiest way to simplify it. And if we can do that with pensions, there's no limit on how many SIPs you can open in a year. You just have to not pay in more than a certain amount of money. If we can do that with pensions, there is no reason why we can't do that with ISAs.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North for our regular weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Yeah, not bad. I mean, unless something surprising happens, we are set for our fourth down week in a row. But let's rewind this time to a month ago. We were saying how September is typically the worst month of the year. And we do have a really nice buffer from the first 6 months to deal with that. Reasons for the move lower, other than seasonality, higher oil prices, which have been on a tear recently, higher bond yields. And I suppose we can put in the looming US shutdown in the mix as well, albeit they rarely influence markets in the long term as things do get sorted pretty quickly. All of that plus a strong dollar and VIX around 20 leaves the bulls licking their wounds a bit. But we are about to enter the best 3 months of the year. Elsewhere, Nike earnings were pretty good. And we also saw Peloton surge higher on a deal with Lululemon.
What do we have coming up next week? Apart, obviously, from the start of the fourth quarter of the year. How do we get that so quickly?
I know, it's mental. The weeks go quicker, the months go quicker, and the quarter goes quicker as well. It's looking likely, as I mentioned, that we're going to have a US shutdown and student loan restart. We also have an OPEC meeting, which will be interesting to watch as oil has been pushing higher, as I mentioned. On Friday, we've got the latest jobs report out of the US, which is always worth focusing on. But some good news for the bulls, as I've mentioned, is October is a seasonally strong month. We're still looking pretty good for the year. But I think we are getting to a point after these four down weeks where the longer term, midterm investors might start getting itchy fingers about buying the dip. The good news is that we know the issues in the markets at the moment. It's only when we start to have new issues that appear that the majority of the market participants don't really know about when panic can start to set in and send markets lower. So yeah, all in all, I think I'm happy to see the end of September. Time for a year-end rally? Probably not just yet, but fingers are crossed.
Thank you very much, Sam. I will speak to you next week. Goodbye.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. It's a year on from the Bank of England's emergency intervention after the disastrous mini budget. Financial markets were plunged into turmoil after former Chancellor, one of the former Chancellors, we've had many, Kwasi Kwarteng, unveiled more than £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts, largely directed at higher earners. The pound plummeted to its lowest level in history, and the government borrowing costs surged to the highest rate since the 2008 financial crisis. So the bank stepped in. It bought up £65 billion of UK government bonds to halt a run on pension funds and wider financial instability. So, Helen... Remember those days? We talk about them enough.
Yeah, they were really good times, weren't they?
Fun times. But, you know, we've had things like the mortgage rates. I mean, they soared after that. They peaked at about 6.5. They've surpassed that over the last few months.
Yeah, they have. And this is all off the back of basically a couple of months ago, those really high inflation figures that really spooked the mortgage lenders, and rates did go higher than they were at the time in the mini budget. I'm not letting Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng off, obviously. The mini budget it's all contributed to where mortgage rates have been in the last year or so. You know, if they hadn't gone to that level then, they wouldn't be able to go to that higher level now, if that makes sense. So mini budget still definitely bad. But there is some good news. So what we've seen since last week, when the Bank of England decided to pause the base rate at 5.25%, we've seen some really quite substantial falls in mortgage rates. So they were kind of going down anyway. They have been for the last couple of months since the inflation reading sort of started to kind of go in the way that we sort of want them to go. You know, we weren't seeing these massively high sort of 10% plus readings anymore. It's now around 6%. So mortgage rates been going down a little bit. But ever since the Bank of England made that decision, lenders have really kind of piled in and I think in the last week or so, almost all the big mortgage lenders have made some quite decent cuts to their mortgage rates. Clearly, they're nowhere near where they were a couple of years ago before all this kicked off. They're probably not going to be for some time. But to give you an idea of the kind of rates we're seeing, the average 5-year fix now, that's across all deposit sizes, is now 5.99%, which sounds really high, and it is high, but it's the first time it's gone below 6% in a really long time. So it shows that things are moving in the right direction. And if you look at a couple of months ago in July, that average was 6.33%. So it's going down. And also the thing to point out is these are averages, and the cheapest deals available are actually much better than those numbers. So we've seen in the last few days, some banks been bringing out 5-year fixes below 5%. So from, I think, Monday, Halifax is doing a 4.93% rate on a 5-year fix. It does have a £1,000 fee, but it's, you know, they're going in the direction where we want them to be going. I should also say that these deals are mostly people with big deposits, and they seem to be better for people buying a house as well, slightly more favourable than people who are remortgaging. But we can now say mortgage rates are going down, which is good.
Is good, and it's that sort of game. Look, if you want to buy a house is sort of, you know, something to live in. But one of the, I suppose, the big question is 2-year, 5-year. I mean, 5-year to fix when, but the base rate could be heading down. They suggest what, middle of next year, maybe.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and I think the reason that 5-year fixes are on these much sort of tastier rates than 2 years. So the average 2-year fix actually at the moment is 6.5%. So that's quite a big gap. The reason for that, I think, well, part of the reason for that is that many more people are choosing a 2-year fix. So banks want to get people locked into that kind of 5-year money. And I think that's generally sensible. You know, if you're fixing a mortgage now, it is difficult to say where things are going to be in 2 years' time, but you would hope that rates would have gone down by the time that people fix again. That said, if you look at analyst predictions, they kind of seem to be saying that mortgage rates will probably stay, I think they're going to go down to about, you know, 4-ish, maybe 4.5%, but they think beyond that, they're not going to go down much further for a few years. So a 5-year fix, it isn't, you know, it isn't an absolute no-go. It could quite possibly work, but I think generally people are kind of thinking, well, you know, I'll pay a bit more for a 2-year fix, but at least I'll have that chance to get out of it, because it is really difficult to tell where things are going. I mean, I don't think there's any way that mortgage rates are going to go back to 2% in the next 5 years, honestly. Mm. But some people might think that could happen. I think we're honestly kind of talking to brokers and things, I think we're going to be at around 4-5% for quite a few years. But then, you know, do you want to gamble with that stuff for just a, you know, a slight difference in your monthly payments? Maybe not. It's hard, it's honestly hard to call.
It is hard to call. You never know. We may have another weird budget moment, mini budget moment, Simon, like we had last year. Who's to know?
I think it's unlikely that Jeremy Hunt's going to throw off the shackles and go all party time chancellor.
But, Simon, you know, Simon, how long? Happen. I mean, there's no way he's going to be in office in 5 years' time. Whether even if Conservatives stay in.
Oh, I thought you meant in November.
Oh, no, no, Simon. I'm saying down the line in the next 5 years. Who knows what can happen?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. I mean, he could be out of office by November. But
there is what common sense says and what the analysts say and what the predictions for interest rates are, which are often wrong, but not, you know, often totally wrong. Though they have most recently been totally wrong. Nobody expected interest rates to go as high as they have done. And then there's the wishful thinking element that comes into play. And I must admit, whilst I know all of the stuff around the analysis and everything about how mortgage rates probably aren't going to fall back down to 2% anytime soon, there is a wishful thinking bit of me that's hoping that they do by the time my 5-year fixed rate mortgage ends in a couple of years. So yeah, who knows? I can see why people are tempted. Brokers reckon there's going to be more of an increase, even more so than recently, in people taking trackers, because they see the base rate as having peaked or it'll only go up one more time. And they want to try and sit and wait for fixed rates to come down, because you can pick up trackers without early repayment charges in the way that you can't pick up fixed rate without early repayment charges. But also that there are, again, a degree of wishful thinkers who are thinking that once interest rates peak, the rate on their tracker mortgage will then start falling as the Bank of England starts cutting interest rates. But yeah, that's definitely on the wishful thinking pile. And as a side note, quickly, before we finish talking about rates, just like to read out an email from one of our readers. Coventry has a new Coventry Building Society has a new 5.2% savings account out. So it matches the old Santander one. Not quite as good as the Santander one, because there's some limits on how many times you can take money out, but 5.2%. So what did we do? We published the story. We sent out a savings alert this morning, and we have an email here from one of our readers, John, who said, many thanks for the heads up on Coventry Building Society's new savings accounts. I missed out earlier in the week, where they fulfilled their subscription within 15 minutes, but was successful today. I also bagged a more attractive cash ISA at the same time. Good work. So there you go. Sign up to our savings alerts. thisismoney.co.uk/alert. Like John.
Be like John. Okay. Which is good, actually, because last time we were talking about this, we mentioned that actually fixed rates could be going down. And I thought, oh, are the savings alerts going to be as kind of fun and tasty as they were if it's just like, you know, these are the best deals and they're just going down? But actually, there are still great deals coming out on the market to be had. So sign up to that. But this weekend, energy price cap edges a bit lower. But will you notice the difference in your bills? And is now the time to fix? Helen, will we notice the difference?
So basically, on Sunday, the Ofgem price cap is going down, which is on paper good news. So it will be £1,923 a year. That's, we have to remember, based on typical usage and a typical household. So if you spend more, if you use more, you will spend more. That's from October until January 2024. But this is Britain in 2023, so it's not as good as it sounds, obviously. Basically, the price cap before this was higher. So last winter, it was £4,279, but we had that government cap that capped it at £2,500. However, we also had those £400 government energy bill support payments, that's £67 that was going into most people's accounts every month. So if you take that into consideration, it's going to be just a little bit cheaper than last winter, but still, it still is cheaper. So that's good.
That is good indeed. No Lee today, Simon, but he is here in spirit. Why?
Okay, because unlike our previous people hoping that interest rates will suddenly come down, and the mortgages will suddenly get cheaper, and so there's no need to fix now. Lee is not the king of wishful thinking. Instead, he has looked at a fixed offer from his energy supplier, which is Shell, but that's moving over to Octopus because Shell have decided they don't want anything to do with the energy market anymore. And he has decided that it is worth him taking out a fixed rate now. I mean, why now? Bills are pretty high. Surely you're fixing at a high level. But he said it is slightly lower than the price cap. It's a 14-month fix. It offers electricity at 30.0010p per kilowatt hour with a standing charge of 44.81p. For gas, the unit rate is 7.5040p per kilowatt hour with an 18.28 standing charge. Both are guaranteed until November 2024. On their current variable deal, which is the price to cap, unit rate slightly higher for electricity with a lower standing charge. For gas, it's a slightly higher unit rate, but with a far higher standing charge. He's frugal with his energy usage. His current forecast is pretty low. And so he reckons that he will do better because he will be paying less money on the standing charge. And he's pretty good at not paying that much money on his energy. And we got some analysis from Cornwall Insights. They pointed to the lower standing charge on deals like this as a good price because it reckons that standing charges are only going to keep rising. Standing charges, Lee's standing charges have gone up by 193% in 7 years. That's quite a big rise. Yeah. The other thing he said is that he checked his account, he's £400 in credit. He reckons he doesn't need that much of a buffer, so he's lowered their monthly direct debit accordingly. So he thinks that people should potentially consider a fix if it's right for them. but also check how much credit they're in and maybe take a bit of money back from their energy supplier, with the massive caveat that it's good to build up a buffer over the warmer months to help cover you in the colder months. And just a warning for anybody who thinks that their energy bills are going to be substantially lower than they were last year on a monthly basis. That's not going to happen. The energy price cap was £2,500. Sorry, the energy price guarantee was £2,500. The price cap is £2,000. There's not that big a difference between those two once you split it down on a monthly level. And also, you've got to remember you're not getting the rebate anymore. And we're going to be doing some numbers on this next week to show people, you know, how their bills are going to compare to last year. But yeah, don't be kind of thinking, oh, great, my bills are going to be so much lower this winter than they were last year. Unfortunately, that's not going to be the case.
On that cheery note, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.